Welcome to the Megan 64 Decade of Perfection recap. We're here to confuse you by talking about comics blogging. For almost a full hour before you get to the panel that you're here to see. We'll try to keep this. We're just going to talk about comics blogging. By comics blogging, we mean flat out comics blogging, and also kind of the culture of writing about comics that's grown out of blogging, a kind of personal diary form that kind of informs the rest of all the online writing about comics. So, and then we'll be talking about comics themselves a little bit. So, I was hoping that the panelists would introduce themselves. I'll start with me. My name is Tom Spurgeon. I do a website called The Comics Reporter. We have a kind of a blog that is in the middle of Comics Reporter, where most of the content shows up first, called CR Briefings. And that's my site. I'm going to be moderating tonight if Heidi asks me. And from my left, I guess we start with Heidi and go left and introduce you all to the folks that have never heard of you.
Well, it's nice to meet y'all. First off, thanks for coming to meet us. My name's Heidi McDonald. I run a blog called The Beat, which has been around in various forms for 10 years. But before that, I was on message boards with a couple people on this panel. I've been online for quite a while. My blog is billed as the news blog of comics culture. I do focus on comics, but I do cover other things that interest me, that I think would be of interest to my readers, to expand it. Because I look here at Comic-Con itself, as it's grown from a tiny gathering to this massive influx of pop culture, comics seem to me to spread out in a lot of ways. So I like to keep my site aware of some of those other edits that are happening.
My name's Tony Isabella. I've probably been doing what's now called blogging longer than anybody else on this panel. I think it's about 20 years. Before that and during that, I was writing for Comics Buyer's Guide. These days, I do a nigh-daily blog called Tony Isabella's Blogging Thing, and I am the patron saint of self-indulgent blogging, because I'll write about whatever I want to write about, whether it's my life, whether it's politics. Put a lot of comics in there because I like comics a lot. Basically, I get up in the morning and write about whatever I want to write about and hope readers enjoy it. But if they don't, I still get up and write it the next day.
My name is Alexa Dickman. I run a Tumblr-based blog called Ladies Making Comics, which is what it sounds like. It focuses on women in the comics field, both past and present, and vaguely future. I try and do a lot of webcomics, too. And, you know, it grew out of just the sort of early Tumblr culture, which was big into theme blogs. And so I thought, oh, I know. I like, you know, a lot of my favorite writers and artists today happen to be women. And then it became, you know, just sort of grew from there because there was a lot of interest in what I was talking about. And I'm here more as the small, you know, personal blog that got out of control, you know, that I created when I was a bored student, and now I'm a grown-up with a real job and still trying to fit it into the margins of my free time. I'm also a moderator on Rich's message board.
This is all we drink here. My name is Rich Johnston. I write a blog, a gossip, rumor, message board thing about comic books and the comic book industry. I'm English, which is quite fun over here, because that seems to be a novelty. And basically, I like to write kind of like tabloid news, I guess. Sensationalist headlines, finding the interesting, the cool, and making a living out of it, which is quite nice.
Rick, do you want to actually name your book?
Did I not?
No. That's surprising.
I'm jet lag. I'm 8 hours. Seriously, bleedingcool.com. It's quite fun.
I'm Graham McMillan. I write for The Hollywood Reporter and Time and Wired. And before that, I've written for far too many comic websites. I've written for Newsarama, Comic Book Resources, Comics Alliance.
Fanboy Rampage.
Yeah, I think that's it. I started as a personal blogger and people kept offering me jobs and I keep saying yes. So I'm here as a seller, I think.
All right. You know, what I have is, like, I want to ask and then I want to go eat dinner.
I've got another panel after this.
I have a seminary degree, and I remember one of our professors telling us that he was going to give us the secret to writing sermons, and he said that if you don't have any, the secret would probably be a grand secret. It's like, if you don't have much to say, keep it short, because everyone will like that one better than anyone you ever did. So if we end up ending a little bit early, no one's going to complain, because that's when we get to Mega 64. here's my question. Tony, you said that you're in this 20 years now. So how many people are is anyone else 10 plus years?
22.
Well, I mean, 20 what?
22.
So what would you, in the 22 years, what is that platform? What were you doing that you can actually call that blogging?
Well, I mean, originally it was a Usenet.
Okay.
A series of columns coming out every week, but published on the Rekart's Comics MISC boards.
Tony, is that where you're drawing your, is that why you count as your first blogging?
I was on Usenet. I think I would, a guy named Justin set up a website, World Famous Comics. And no, actually, I first started doing something called Tony Isabella's Journal on, and I'm blanking on the name of it. We all used to be there.
Comic-Con?
CompuServe,
that was it, yes. I did it on CompuServe, and then it moved to World Famous Comics. And then somewhere along the line, I just started doing it on my own.
So how many are any of you 10 years in? You're about 10 years in?
I'm 10 this year, yeah.
I mean, I was on CompuServe too, but I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, we had horrible fights. I mean, you know, me and Tom and Rich and Tony, we used to argue all the time on CompuServe. That's why I called the panel Family Feud, you know, so we can continue our arguments.
Alexa, how long have you been doing this?
About 2.5 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I know. It's old on Tumblr time.
How many of you can say that half of your income comes from your blogging or writing activities?
All of it.
All of it.
Yeah. I would make all, half. All of mine. Half.
So all of your income comes from blogging?
From that and garage sales.
I would say about half of mine comes from my blogging too. Yeah. And Alexa, yours is not generated.
I make my coffee money via affiliate links on Amazon.
How many of you are doing? How many are you doing both individual blogging and group blogging? Graham, you would qualify in there?
Where
different people are contributing to what you're doing?
Yeah, I'm all group then. Hollywood Reporter and Time, yeah.
And all the rest of you are kind of solo platforms?
Bleeding Cool's expanded. It started being just me, and now it's grown into a number of voices.
Same
here. I mean, I've had, you know, as the world of comics has expanded, I've found other people who... Because I couldn't do it all, you know, and I wanted to find some good people to do it.
And I still don't play well with others.
and my thing is all me, so we have two of us.
Yeah, my blog's all me. I've tried to reach out to other websites, and other websites have reached out to me about contributing, but I just haven't had the time.
We know a lot of people on Tumblr, the actual blog itself, but how many do you all supplement your blogging with social media?
Oh, I definitely do.
Not a lot. I mean, little bits, but no, not really.
Yeah, so you have a Twitter feed, though.
I have a Twitter feed, though, so that whenever there's a new post on Bleeding Cool, a link will go out on like Twitter and Facebook, but I'm not constantly adding stuff to that. Again, there's a ton of it, it's just repeating what's up on the Bleeding Cool. I try to keep my writing for the site.
I have a Facebook page that started out as just a promotional tool and then became... so much fun that you know, I devote a lot. I do remembrances of old artists and everything, and writers on their birthdays. I do messages from the First Church of Godzilla, of which I am the pastor. All praise the Great Scaly One, and stuff like that. So Facebook ended up becoming, you know, started out as a promotional tool for my blog and stuff, and ended up becoming a party for me.
I tweet a lot because. My thoughts are very short.
Yeah, I tweet as well, but I almost never link to any of my work on Twitter. I tweet under the Hollywood Reporter name as well.
Yeah, I think the idea is that I have a Twitter account as well, that I would tweet to drive people to the site, but it hasn't been that way. I mostly tweet just in, so I call it the Great Insult Machine. It's just kind of insult people on Twitter. So everyone has a social... And I guess the last question I have is to kind of get an idea of what the group's picture of the group is. Rich, I know that you have a print magazine that kind of comes off the side. Is anyone else either in print or have the ambition to work in print based on what you're writing
now? I've done print.
Okay, you've done print, but has it come out of the blogging?
Yeah.
Okay.
I actually did print before I did any blogging.
But is it leading to print? I mean, is it going to be a collection, or is that...
You know, maybe another sequel to the 1,000 comic books you must read. I've thought about it. It's just not something I've worked on yet.
I've worked in and out of print. In print my whole career. I mean, I currently also work for a magazine, Publishers Weekly. I definitely get offers from printed entities that would be like to write things for print, you know.
All right, I have three questions from your fellow writers about comics. One is from Pam Knowles, sent a question in. And her question was essentially, we wondered about kind of using terms like exclusive and other maybe highlighted words that allow search engines to find you, those kind of practices. How much any of you pay attention to driving traffic to your writing online that way? And if you do, if that ever kind of stands in the way of any ethical concerns doing so. In other words, do you feel like calling everything exclusive is dumb? Or throwing in a Harry Potter reference is silly? Do you ever feel that that's kind of not what you got into writing for? How do you deal with kind of maximizing your traffic potential that way?
In various places I've worked, I've had to do that more than I do now. I wrote for IO9 for 2 years, and that was a big thing.
Where?
Saying exclusive, saying, like, putting in the buzzwords, SEO, the whole thing. And it would drive the story sometimes, and I didn't like that at all.
Well, I clearly haven't done that, but that's because I didn't know you could. I didn't know that worked. Just saying exclusive get you more traffic. If so, I'm going to start doing it, because no one told me. I don't put in pop culture people because I just haven't really occurred to me. Just writing stuff. Maybe I should now make everything exclusive. Thanks. It's a good tip. Thanks.
I'm here for you, Rich. Always have been.
I mean, I sometimes people... I know where this question is going. A lot of times companies will go to you and say, we want you to break this script. They actually, I think, want you to put exclusive in front of it. I mean, because they are giving it to you to, you know, help everybody. And I don't really do a lot of exclusives. I don't know, it doesn't fit in with my personality. But once in a while, somebody says, oh, we want to break this story. And it's usually the less interesting, I shouldn't say this, but the less interesting a story is, the more the word exclusive helps, you know? I mean, I would use the word exclusive if it's like, you know, exclusive change on a DC book. I mean, wow, that is such incredible news, you know, that there's been a personnel change on a DC book. So, you know, putting the word exclusive sort of gives a little tag to the reader that they know that this information, in theory, they didn't read on Rich's site yesterday.
Well, I know when I sit down to write each day's installment of exclusive Tony, exclusive Isabella's, exclusive blog, exclusive thing, I don't really give a rat's behind. I literally, when I say I'm self-indulgent, I really am. I don't care about a lot of stuff that happens in comics. If it interests me, I write about it. If it doesn't, I don't. If anybody reads my blog, I'm thrilled, but I'm still writing it basically for myself. I'm a terrible person.
God bless you.
Yeah. I can't really say I get too many exclusives, but I mean, I get a lot of art students asking me to look at their webcomic.
You ever gussy up the articles to more appealing to people?
I did actually take a course, like a one-day workshop on search engine optimization, and, you know, for about a week tried to implement. I mean, even just little things like making sure you rename your URL so that it's more SEO, you know. But I'm just like, I can't even be bothered. My main goal was basically to get myself curated into Tumblr's comics category of their, like, sort of top blogs, and I achieved that about 9 months ago, so I'm good.
I mean, I sometimes, you know, some of my writers would do an interview, and it would be like, you know, interview Ed Brubaker. And, you know, people who are interested in Ed Brubaker will read that, but it could be a little bit more enticing. So I don't necessarily think it's gussying up. I mean, I feel it's that you should give something fun and interesting and pique the interest of people who are going to see 8,000 things floating on their Twitter feed or something. So, I mean, I give my writers, you know, a little bit more advice. Like, you know, do a pull quote. Do something that's from the story that gives a feeling. So, I mean, I'm not going to say that once in a while I didn't put an SEO word in there just because, you know, I do depend on this to pay my rent.
Like, what's an SEO word?
Well, okay, this is a perfect example. And
I'm taking notes, hang on.
Yeah, I did this totally on purpose to see if it would work, and it totally did, and then I didn't do it again. So the morning after the Oscars this year, Renee Zellweger had a meltdown on stage, and which I felt bad for her, but it was also very amusing, because it seemed... Anyway, she couldn't read, and like her fellow presenters wouldn't even, you know, let her read the thing because she couldn't read. They were making fun of her for it. So I put, you know, Oscar mystery. What was wrong with Renee Zellweger? And I mean, it was huge traffic because in the morning everybody was like, "What was wrong with Renee Zellweger?" So, you know, it worked. I thought it was fun. I mean, I didn't write it because, you know, I said, "Oh my God, I've got to get traffic," like Graham did. I mean, I wrote it because it was something that I thought was pretty funny, actually, and you know, I mean, but you can do that. I mean, that's what the web is all about. I mean, if I wanted to double my traffic, I would do SEO all the time, and you know, a lot of times it's just too much work.
Don't you want to double your traffic?
I do, but not at the expense of being accurate and presenting things, because after a while, you know, you beat the horse too much and they don't believe you anymore.
And another problem is that, you know, Google keeps changing their sort of notability rankings, because once people learn how to game them, Google's like, well, then now this search engine is useless.
Yeah, and Google's new current trend is to get higher in our rankings, you must do good content. And so I feel that's a very good goal.
You know, I might have done this accidentally without, you know, when I think about it, because for the longest time, I try to come up with a clever title just because they amuse me. And for the longest time, the most read blog entry I did was called Jim Shooter's Pants Are on Fire. and then that only recently got supplanted by Dragon Con Dies at the End. So I guess I've done it, but I haven't really done it to try to get more traffic. I just came up with something clever and said, hey, this amuses me. So I used it as a title.
There's one thing I had. When the Avengers film came out, I thought, talking to Americans, no one knew what Mewling Quim meant. So I just did an article about what does Mewling Quim mean. I just read it. Just thought it would be a useful thing. And that has been one of Bleeding Cool's highest traffic posts to date. If you want to know what Mewling Quim means, you can look it up on Bleeding Cool.
That is the most depressing thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I'm a Comic-Con. Joe McCullough, Jog the Blog, has a question for you guys. He says that he started blogging because he wanted to find his individual voice. But now that he participates mostly in group blogs, he wonders if his voice isn't lost into the loudest and the most lowest common denominator type voices of the sites where he contributes. If he's allowed to keep his individual voice. To those of you, and I guess this is Graham mostly, when you contribute to a group blog, do you worry about keeping your individual voice?
Yes.
Okay.
And depending on where it is, I try and write towards what the blog wants. So, for example, for Wired, I think it wants more of a group voice than Hollywood Reporter does. On Hollywood Reporter, I tried to write fairly anonymously and was given into trouble by the editors who said, that's not why we hired you. So, yeah, it depends. IO9, again, I think, wanted a sort of generic IO9 voice. that I had to learn. So it depends on where I'm writing for.
Rich and Heidi, do you feel like since you brought in writers, do you worry about your site losing its platform for your own voice and kind of the sea of voices? Are you comfortable with that?
I'm comfortable. I'm very comfortable with other people developing their own style. You know, I think some of my writers have definitely, you know, gotten way more of a following since they've been writing on my site, and I'm super, you know, pleased with that. So I'm not. This is a horrible egotistical thing to say, but you know, I have a little bit of Tony's self-indulgence there. I mean, I'm gonna write like I write. You know, I mean, since I write every single friggin' day, you know, I sort of know what is going to happen now. So I'm more interested when I see something that surprises me on my own site. Then I'm like, wow, that was really cool.
Jacob Goddard would like to know, for those of us that use other writers, which I think would be Rich and Heidi and myself, do we pay the writers? What do we pay them? And if we don't pay them, does that make us hypocritical or otherwise unable to go after companies that exploit their creators? I'll go first. I pay my writers. I have a columnist and I use occasional writers. I pay $100 an article, which is awful, but it's what I can afford. And yeah, I worry about the fact that that might be hypocritical to exploit writers to write for the site, which is why I don't use a lot of writers. Rich, do people get paid writing for Bleeding Cool?
It depends. Some do, some don't, depending on who they are, depending on what they're writing, what they're contributing. Some people use it as a place to promote their work, and they're probably going to be working it for free. That's part of the deal. Some people, it's what they're doing all day, and they're going to get paid. Some people who are writing from the show this weekend, their payment is basically they've gotten to San Diego for free without having to get in the lottery of getting the tickets through. And so it's almost like we can get you into the show if you're going to cover it for us. So we make deals. And some of it is money, some of it's access, some of it's exposure. If I'm a hypocrite, yeah, probably am. I usually am.
When you pay, can you ballpark what you pay?
Well, I mean, again, I'm not the guy who's paying. It's my employer, Avatar Press.
Okay. But,
and then it's generally not per item. It's we're paying you to work on the site and do your work for us. So... So it's generally not a per item payment. It's more of a salary, I guess. And that's only what I'm on.
Last year when I had an extra job and I was making lots and lots of money and I was paying my writers. But it was a very, very bare minimum. And, you know, I'm not proud to say how much it was. I will say, because this is an important question, and it's not comfortable for me, and it's something I struggle with a lot, but, you know, I was paying them $5 a post. That is the lowest possible you can do. It was what I could afford at that time. Unfortunately, after that, I had some financial difficulties, and I could no longer afford to pay that. So I do, at this point, I guess I do exploit my writers. And, you know, that will be the pull quote on Rich's blog tomorrow. Heidi McDonald, I exploit my writers.
Good idea. Thank you. Hang on.
I sent
more notes of you. You're good at this.
No, but I'm not hiding it. And it's not something I'm comfortable with. And I'm extremely aware of the question. And am I exploiting people for, you know, in the way that I really come off against on my site? I mean, I'm very, very pro creators' rights. And I'm trying, as Rich was saying, in the times that I'm not paying writers, to give them as much as I can, you know, to give them as much help that I can or as much exposure as they can, you know, to that they do. And, you know, I know everybody's doing things for exposure. I do think that model of doing things for exposure, I think discoverability is definitely a currency right now. And, you know, finding themselves. I mean, you know, Steve Morris is somebody who had his own site anyway. And then I said, why don't you come write for The Beat? And, I mean, he's definitely become much better known for writing for The Beat. And I feel he's going to leave me now and go get a paying job. And you know what? I'm thrilled with that. I'm thrilled that he would get to a place. The thing I would be most thrilled with is when my site starts making money again. And when the site is flush, I pay my writers. And, you know, I need to get it as flush as it can be in order to do that. And so that's a goal for all of us.
Well, there's one other.
sorry.
It's just there's one other aspect, just the Bleeding Cool thing. One of the things is the writers who certainly do write for free, they are also auditioning for the magazine. And the magazine pays. Because a lot better than the website does. And we basically recruit pretty much from the website. It's just another way of doing it.
And do you think it makes reduces your ability to be does it reduce your moral authority in writing articles about the exploitation of the comics business if you're exploiting?
I'm glad this came up because this is a subtext that a lot of people are talking about. I mean, it's something I struggle with, you know, and I mean, I Henry, my writer's sitting right there, you know, and Henry, if you feel exploited, leave, you know, like, all right. I talk to my writers all the time about it, and I tell them, you know, this is how I feel about it, you know, you should be aware of this, and, you know, all my writers also own all their material. I mean, I said that, you know, I have absolutely no claim to it. Go put it on your own blog, you know, the next day or the next minute or whatever, you know. So, I mean, I'm hoping that what I'm doing in, mentor is a way too strong a word, but at least I hope that in what I'm doing is offering a platform where people can grow from. I hope that affords some kind of recompense for it, and I'm, you know, nobody does it against their will. That, you know, I'm not forcing anyone to do anything.
That would be,
you know,
cool if you could.
Well, I would like to do things, you know, but that would be wrong. But, you know, I mean, I give suggestions. I mean, I do say, like, yeah, you better write a better headline. I do give, and I, you know, I try to bring them in and help them to grow the site.
Rich, do your writers own their material?
Sorry?
Do they own their material?
Yeah.
Okay. Brian, do you own the material that you write for other sites?
Not at all.
Which ones don't you own?
I don't own anything I'm writing right now.
So what are those sites?
Time, Wired, and Hollywood Reporter own everything that I write.
So Wired and Hollywood Reporter actually buy the articles outright?
Yes.
Okay. That's good to know.
Tom.
Yes, sir.
You said you pay $100 a quote.
I just can't afford that. You know, that's the thing.
Is that how much you pay people for?
Yeah, the, like Bart Beatty. I have a columnist named Bart Beatty, and I paid David that amount recently. I mean, I'm trying.
Probably more than.
Yeah, that's more than we pay at Publishers Weekly.
That's an amazing amount more than.
I just don't think. I mean, I come from.
You're paying him too much, I think. Is the what I'm going to say here. You need to cut that in half.
Heidi has suggested I can make them write for free. But no, I mean, I come from a culture in writing where I wrote for sites in the late 90s. Where you're getting a lot of money. And it just seems wrong to me not to pay what I can, and so I don't. I think that's the least amount. Well, I would pay three times that much if I could, but
yeah,
I'm
not condemning you for paying that. I'm just saying that I mean, compared to just, most of the
websites. People want to write all the time for me, and I just can't. I can't afford even that horrible amount, so it just seems like, why do it?
And I mean, you know, I get approached from time to time, although less and less, because. You know, Tom and I were on a panel together in Toronto called Is Blogging Dead? And, you know, it's not the most up-to-date thing anymore. But, you know, I get always the approach to buy the site and this and that, and, you know, we'll take it over and everything. And you know, it would be like, oh, now you're going to get paid more. I mean, that would be my absolute wonderful dream would be to make Tom's very generous payment of $100 look like, you know, chicken feed. I mean, I wish I could. I wish there was a way to monetize and to do that. I mean, that would absolutely.
I'm sort of uncomfortable with the structure where paying someone $100 is generous.
Yeah, but I mean
that's just,
holy crap.
Ludicrous to me. I mean, I guess it's ludicrous. I guess it's not ludicrous because that's the context that we work in now. But it just seems like, I don't know.
But were fanzines any different?
It's a good question.
When I wrote for the Buyer's Guide, Tony Austin wrote for. Actually, when I started the Comics Journal, I made a penny a word, and the Buyer's Guide paid $3 a word. So, of course, I wanted to write for the Buyer's Guide. I saved up, I looked at my bank account, and I've been writing for these penny a word, 3 cents a word outlets, and I saved up $1,000. I mean, I had written a lot to make that, you know. I kind of amazed myself. But, yeah, I mean, $1,000 back then made a... worth a lot more than it is now, so. And some places still pay like pennies a word, you know.
I mean, Comics doesn't look as bad because everybody sucks now. I mean, like Rolling Stone pays like those giant like recaps of television shows, they're paying like $75, $100 for those, which just strikes me as pure insanity for all the effort that's put into those. When I worked at the Comics Journal in the mid-90s, we paid some writers 4 or 5 cents a word, some 3 cents a word, I guess, by the mid-90s, which was horrifying. And most people paid, like, your shitty... Excuse me, I didn't mean to... the decade of imperfection for me continues. But the shitty gigs were 25 cents a word, and the regular gigs were, like, $1 a word back in the day. A site I wrote for in the late 90s called Suck.com was paying... $800 for 1,000-word essays?
Yeah, online. Jesus.
For online work? So it's a different world. Someone's making money out there, but certainly as many of the writers. And I don't know if it's a bad thing. I mean, I just kind of wonder if it's worth using people at all if you can't pay them. But I think we've beaten that to death. And I like beating things to death.
So that's a pull quote. That's what I'm using.
Let's talk about some issues. Do you consider yourself an issue writer? I mean, do you write about issues? Do you have an axe that you grind? I just want to pull you into the
Occasionally.
I want to pull you into the conversation.
Occasionally I do. I mean, something I say often is that the history of comics is a history of very talented creative people being screwed over by the suits. And yeah, I write about that. It's happened to me. It's happened to people I love and respect. It happens today. So I'll write about that from time to time. I don't think I'm a one-issues writer, but yeah, I get on my little soapbox and I have go at it.
So Reader's Rights, let's talk about that real quick. Let's talk about 3 or 4 issues before we wrap this up and maybe get some questions in from the audience. But Reader's Rights, since Tony brought it up, is there anything, and I'll leave this open to anyone, that was not, my impression was when the Creator's Bill of Rights was a document that came out in the late 80s, early 90s from a group of independent artists. And when the 20th anniversary of that rolled around, people weren't interested in celebrating that. Recent issues in comics such as the Before Watchmen comics and Alan Moore's treatment by DC Comics have kind of put those issues back on the table. Where are we with creator rights? Who of you writes about creator rights, and what would you like people to know, or what would you prefer people write about creator rights if they were going to write about that? Is it a concern of yours, Rich?
It's a big bleeding cool concern. It's something we write about a lot because we get a lot of traffic about it. So
where do you want us to get to? 4 years from now, Rich Johnson runs the world. We're all talking in strange accents. We're all self-deprecating humorous.
Well,
does creators write?
All right, right now, wouldn't it be nice if everything was like Image? That would do.
When I was in law school, I concentrated in intellectual property, and actually all of the work-for-hire cases, the cases that we used to understand what work-for-hire actually meant, they were all comic book related.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It was Gaiman McFarlane, some Kirby case, some Siegel case, and a Simon and Marvel case. Personally, I also used to work for an entertainment lawyer when I was in law school, and I loved reading the fee schedules from the various guilds. I thought this was absolutely fascinating and such a great idea, and why didn't comics have one? And, you know, I've come to find out it's been tried like 8 million times. I did once write an open letter to the Writers Guild of America because of Jerry Conway, who's a comics writer and a member of the Writers Guild, was basically getting screwed over for the Punisher. And so I said to the Writers Guild, maybe you should have a policy that you don't make movies based on properties, you know, unless, you know, by member creators, unless, you know, you get some sort of respect. But I didn't get any feedback from that. So that's the first thing I would do, I think, if I ruled the world.
Actually, there's one thing that Tony just mentioned before then about the possibility of, like, a history of suits screwing over creators. There's something I think I've grown to understand while writing Bleeding Cool, moreover, but quite a lot of the time it's the creators screwing over creators. And that's something that hasn't been touched on as much. It's something we try to do, but it's still everyone seems to think about the screwing is the suits versus is the man versus the artist. Sometimes the artist is doing it to their fellow artists, and that's.
Well, you know, Tony's class is you're not.
I mean, you could. Okay, there was. Sometimes it's the irony. It was when we did a piece with Len Wein, who was talking about how the ending of Before Watchmen didn't quite work out because his stuff was taken away from him and his plans were just dropped, and he felt he was a bit screwed over by it. And you could just feel the irony dripping off every word with those pictures. So that's the kind of thing that sticks out to me, I guess.
Okay. Well, I just to jump in here, I mean, I do think, just the time I've been doing the beat, I think things have really improved and because of the ubiquity of information. And you know, I wrote a couple of posts about this, but, you know, even 6 years ago, there was a lot of IP companies and, you know, like, you know, Platinum and, you know, I mean, Tokyo Pop had a lot of questions, and they were, like doing these contests and getting a lot of people in and holding on to the rights forever. And, you know, people learned the hard way that they had given up some of their prime creations. To both of those, and I see far fewer of those now. So I think something good is happening in that way, in that creators just seem to be a little bit more informed that they can put it on Tumblr. They can put it on Tumblr, and they don't have to have Tokyo Pop publish it for them. And I think just in the way that younger creators are just doing it, it's very DIY. It's just, you know, do it, and you know, everybody quotes to me, just do what you love, and the money will come. You know, so that's like the modern underpants gnomes or whatever. But
no, to that end, I think Kickstarter helped a lot. You know, if anyone wants to have their comic published, they don't have to sell their soul and copyrights to get it done. They just ask the readers they already have.
You know, when I write about some of the awful, awful, awful mistakes that I've made, and how I've been screwed over by companies, I sometimes get characterized as this bitter old guy. And I don't deny, you know, that there's some bitterness there. But actually, you know, if I can serve as a horrible object lesson to younger creators, if they could say, I don't want what happened to Tony to happen to me, I'm good with that. I've accomplished something.
You know, you get to a certain age, you realize all you have to give people is your negative example. Which is liberating.
Don't do what I do, kids. Don't do drugs. Stay in school.
Gender issues. I assume everyone here writes about gender issues at some point.
Yeah.
What is the positive formulation of gender issues? Where would we like to be a year from now that we're not? Where would we like to be 5 years from now that we're not, in terms of all the issues that face? You know, I have a problem. I'm always a little bit confused by gender issues in comics because sometimes I hear about them in terms of creators and people that work in comics, and sometimes I hear about it in terms of characters. And I'm always a little confused by processing issues that seem to want to apply to both Kelly Sue DeConnick and Batgirl. But I wonder if you're the panelists, what the positive formulation of gender issues is right now. Where are we with that? Where are we where we should be if we could get there?
Well, speaking from the creator end, I would say I think the general feeling is that we are on a positive upswing in terms of gender diversity and also diversity in general amongst the creative field. Where the sort of disconnect comes from is, well, who are they writing for? And there is this weird sort of perception, which is interesting to talk about right after we get through creators' rights and, you know, the suit screwing over the artist, because there seems to be this measure of success that if you are, you know, the 900th person writing Batman, you've made it. You know, whereas people who are telling their own stories and, you know, just doing it for themselves are sort of seen as, well, you know, good for you. You know, you're getting there. You know, so to me, it's really interesting. I think really we're going to get, probably not within 5 years, but the future of comics, there's, you know, I don't think that Marvel and DC are going to figure into it quite as much. I mean, obviously they'll still exist and the properties will still exist, but I wouldn't really be surprised if within 20 years they're not producing original material anymore and they're just living off of, you know, the trademarks.
I think that might be 20 days. you know, I just want to say Alexa also I mean, you do the historical site also.
Yeah, I have a wiki as well.
A wiki of women cartoonists, and I mean, it's so, I am so impressed by it. And I mean, you have people on there I never heard of, and when you look, you have it arranged by, like, you know, Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age.
Categorized.
Yeah.
I'm big into categories.
And there's all these women who are working in comics at every era I've never heard of, that are never written about. You know, lost women is a real thing, and I just think it's so important to go back and look at where you've been, you know. And I think, you know, with Tony talking about getting screwed over, I think a lot of the historical information that's available right now, I think that is a really important thing, and I just hope that a lot of people pay attention to it, so you don't have to feel like I'm inventing it again and again and again. But just one other thing on gender, though, I will say, to the characters, because it always comes back to the characters. You know, just yesterday, the president of DC was quoted, you know, with Wonder Woman. It's like, oh, we've got to do a Wonder Woman movie, but it's just so hard. Oh, it's so hard. How do we do it?
There was a TV series that ran for 3 years.
Why does it, they may be like a giant monster fights, and she has to get out and fight the monster. That's my idea. I mean, with
But there's a Joss Whedon script just sitting there.
I think they should just hire Marvel to make the movie. For that.
No, what I thought was funny about the fact that the Joss Whedon script was turned down because it involved too much mythology, and he said it during World War II, and Warner Brothers was like, that'll never work, and then Disney within the same Marvel within the same summer releases Thor and Captain America, and both are wildly successful. And then the Avengers is directed by Joss Whedon.
It's always nice to see these little things, like the Red Sonja piece that Dynamite announced for the show, where Gail's getting a whole bunch of female writers to write the new Red Sonja series, and it was just the observation that in one book from Dynamite there are more female writers than in Marvel and DC and Image for the year. And I thought, that's the kind of thing that embarrasses people. And one thing that makes people change, do what they're doing, is someone's being embarrassed. And that can happen. So that's what, certainly what Bleeding Cool likes to do. With the things like our gender crunching columns that we do every month, we like to embarrass people. And eventually, the idea is hopefully embarrassment might make them change, or make them, you know, just not care anymore.
But sometimes they can be kind of tone deaf, because when Becky Cloonan was the first woman to ever draw an issue of Batman, it's like, that was a couple months ago, and Batman has existed since 1940. I don't know if you want to brag about that.
It's true.
Grant, you do well about those issues. You're passionate about those issues. Is there an aspect of gender?
I would love to.
Issues in comics you'd love to see?
I would love people to understand it. I think there's a sort of entrenched gender is, talking about gender is bad and difficult, and it's not what superhero comics or comics are about, and there's just this refusal to even engage in the subject. It'd be nice for people to actually just talk about it and try and learn about it.
It's one of those things I think people can't help but feel attacked for some reason, because if you point out, well, you know, this comic, you know, this portrays women kind of sexistly, you know, well, I enjoyed this comic, so you're calling me a sexist, and oh my god, how can you, you know, I'm not, well, I have a mother, like, you know.
Yeah, exactly, they're trying to shut down the conversation.
And it's just like,
I reject your entire premise,
right,
it's over.
Right.
Yeah.
We've all written articles, or at least many of us in the blogs have written articles drawing or driving attention to creators in need. We have a generation of older creators that's maybe different than the generation that came previously, in that there's less of an industry that they're a part of, less of a regular wage, perhaps, in prime earning years of their lives. I worry that we're headed towards kind of a potentially apocalyptic group of broke-ass creators heading into their golden years, in which I will be leading the church. So is there any... Since we've all written about that, is there anything that worries you in terms of creators in trouble?
Yeah.
The lack of support and attention and the money that ends up in the hands of creators? Is that a concern for you?
I've got two big ones, actually. One is what happens to the comic book creators who people don't like. and so you do a big appeal, and they're all who aren't very good. And they haven't got a fan following, and cut the money. I mean, this is the other thing. There's no. I've never seen an appeal for my British comic book creator, because it's just never kind of come up.
Because we all hate the British.
Well, no, it's just because we have a different. Exactly. Yeah. There are bigger problems at hand here as well. I mean, these are big problems, but it feels like things like the Hero Initiative and stuff feels like a big sticking plaster, and it's
not just comics.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's not just. What about people who aren't who don't have that talent, who don't have the fan following, and they're just left to rot. So they're, it feels like
should've written better comics.
There we go. You see, it's the hideous destruction of the meritocracy, and it's. I find that sickening, and it's the kind of thing that I'll. But then what do? Do you just not run the stories? Do you not put up the peels because you've got some kind of moral problem with that? Obviously not. But that's one of those things that troubles me on a constant basis, and it gets me very angry.
Yeah, actually, I recently ran a story about a 93-year-old Golden Age creator named Barbara Hall. You know, she's alive and, you know, living with her children on this artist colony she founded back in the 40s. But she just needs like a live-in assistant, you know, and it's, you know, free room and board, you know, an hour away from the Center of Cartoon Studies. I was like, I thought this post would be so popular. It got 8 notes.
Tony, I mean, you must have seen people you know in these circumstances.
Oh,
anything that,
constantly. And going back to when I started at Marvel in the 70s. But back then, you could usually find some sort of job for creators. There was more anthology-type books. I was enough of a force at that time that I could make a few phone calls and get guys some jobs to tie them over until they could find something else. But yeah, it's a major concern, and thank you. Know, I mean, I'm very lucky. I have a life that my wife has built for me that allows me to do the kind of things that I get to do without worrying about stuff. But there's so many creators out there that don't have that. Guys who are incredibly talented writers who drive cabs. You know, one of the best writers comics has ever had is a guy named Don McGregor. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there isn't a new Don McGregor comic book every month is appalling. You know, and Don struggles, and he does get some stuff out there. And there's just so many guys like that. Pretty much half the guys that came into the industry that I did are not in comics anymore. And yeah, that's a loss to comics, and it's a shame because these guys did some good work. And even the ones who didn't do good work gave it their all. Nobody sets out to write a bad comic book.
I'd just like to throw in there that, you know, the Hero Initiative is a charity in comics that does taking money to give to older creators who are in need. It's kind of like a crisis fund, I guess you'd say. And then, you know, they do some very good work. And I mean, I would love to see this. I think you're absolutely right about this, Tom. I think that this issue has to get more visibility and has to be talked about more. And, you know, especially when it's tied into all the issues with the creators of these movies, these billion-dollar franchises and everything. And, you know, I would hope that you know, for celebrities who come here to Comic-Con, it's cool now to be at Comic-Con. It's cool to be associated with the nerds. And, you know, I'd hope that some way it can become cool to be doing benefits, maybe, for some older creators. I mean, maybe, you know, Robert Downey.
That is cool.
Yeah, it is.
That's a great
idea.
And,
you know, honestly, if you went to, you know, I mean, I don't know Robert Downey Jr. personally, but, I mean, there are certain celebrities who, one of them said, you know, if you did this charity and helped some older comics creators, it would be really cool, and they would like to do it because a lot of actors feel very guilty about their lives, and they'll get by doing charities and lose their image a lot. So it's a win-win for them.
I would also urge everyone here and everyone on the panel to write realistically about financial issues in comics so that we don't lose the next generation, the generation where many of the practitioners are going to be in debt from school for comics, that we don't promise them a salary or a So what I have here to sum up is that suits are evil, we don't understand gender issues, and we're all going to die broke and alone. So I'm 10 minutes away from eating. I'll take a question if anyone has a question for the panelists before we take off.
Go for it.
Anyone? Yes, you look very attentive.
He's right in the
middle
of your word.
Yeah, so I was just wondering, going back to the topic of gender issues, a character who has a good weakness or a very well-developed weakness, it makes the character more engaging. And I'm wondering, with a character like Wonder Woman, who is a really interesting character and is kind of like a role model for a lot of women and young girls out there, who has such a terrible weakness that was created by a renowned bondage fetishist. How would you, in your personal opinions, address something like that if you were to make like a movie or move it forward?
I always thought you'd just open the movie where she flies that invisible plane into the Wayne Manor, and then she drags Batman out of bed and just beats the shit out of him for like 10 minutes. And that just establishes her badass proper.
Actually,
you don't care how she's dressed.
Yeah. But speaking to that, Marston definitely had some bondage interests, but Trina Robbins likes to point out that at the time in comics, women were getting tied up all the time, you know, but the difference with Wonder Woman is that she was the one who broke her own bounds. And so, I mean, I think, you know, it's sort of cliche to do the whole, oh, you know, show the woman in peril thing, but if you could, you know, if you could get that sort of feeling, I think, in a scene where she's tied up, you know, in a movie, you know, you might make it, you know, you might kind of start it out as maybe seeming kind of like sexy and fetishy and then just have it go in completely the other direction.
This is Adam Woman's empowered.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you look in fiction, there's tons of heroines. You know, especially for YA. I mean, you know, they just they go out and they do shit. You know, I mean, it's not that hard, unless you're a woman.
You look very disapproving.
It's all cross arms.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you might see as the disconnect between kind of the online world and the real world in terms of sales and perception. I'm on Rich's site a lot, I'm on CBR a lot, I'm on a lot of your sites, and, you know, people come in and they'll rave about certain books, and they'll poo-poo other books, and then you turn around and you look at the sales data, and you look at which books survive and which books don't, and it's so disheartening to see that disconnect there. And so do you feel that the online blogging, but online in general, isn't reaching the larger audience, or isn't representative of the larger audience a lot?
No.
No.
It's representative of a really hardcore kind of devoted audience. And there's uses for that. I mean, like a hardcore audience can kickstart a book or draw attention to an issue. They're the people that are more likely to give money to something if something needs to be done. But it doesn't represent the real world. I think the real world's overrated.
I know.
It's the snakes on a plane thing. It's like, you know, everyone talks about it online and no one shows up at the
I disagree with that completely. I'm seeing much more correlation between online attitudes and sales, and the things are just growing. I mean, the growth of digital comics is a really good example of that. You're seeing a big change in the way comics are being consumed.
And I would also say that, you know, the reason we run our sites is that we can sometimes teeny bit move the needle, you know, and when we champion work that we really believe in, it could get more of an audience. And, you know, just real quick, because I know you guys are waiting for your panel, so I run as many sales charts as I can, and I've started running this guy who does the Amazon sales charts, and if you look at them, they give a very different story, and BookScan gives a very different story, and what libraries check out give very different stories. There's a lot of different audiences for comics, and what I try to do a lot is to get as much of that information out as I can. So
we leave you to the decade of perfection.